Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, I want to take a moment and talk about the over-incarceration of young people of color. And what is the long-term and short-term impact of that? What can we do about it? And where are the places that we can begin to lean in? I'm joined now by one of my favorite people, Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, the president of UMBC. He's a consultant on science and math education. He was named by President Obama to chair the President's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans. He has been named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine in 2012. And I just have such high hopes for the ways in which he's going to continue to rise. I will definitely be voting for him when he runs for president. Dr. Hrabowski, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Dr. K. Just know all of UMBC sings your praises. We're very, very proud of you. Very much so.
Thank you very much. And for folks, you know, full disclosure, I received my PhD from UMBC. And Dr. Hrabowski, I tell this story every time I talk about you, so I'm going to take the liberty of day to tell this story. Folks, when I was working on my PhD, I had my young sons on campus. They were 4 and 5 years old, Kofi and Amir. And one day, walking across campus, as I was dragging my sons off to my evening class, we met Dr. Hrabowski. And he got down on one knee, and he spoke to my sons, and he told them a story about how he used to call himself Dr. Hrabowski, starting at the age of 13. Folks, the next morning when I woke up, my 4 and 5 year old sons were calling themselves Dr. Whitehead. And now that my son is a sophomore in college and I have a senior in high school, their goal is to become Dr. Whitehead. And they want to do what Dr. Hrabowski did so that one day someone will call them Dr. Whitehead. So thank you for just inspiring them all those years ago.
Thank you. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
I also have Sam Abed Esquire, who began his tenure as the Secretary of the Maryland Department of Juvenile Services in March 2011. Mr. Esquire, how are you, sir?
Actually, Mr. Abbott, yeah. But
Mr. Abbott.
Dr. K, I'm doing just fine. No. And I join your praise of Dr. Hrabowski. He's an amazing person, and he's somebody that touched my life when I first moved here to Maryland, and I'm so glad that I came into his orbit and that I still am.
Well, Secretary Abbott, I really appreciate you. You were chosen by the governor of Maryland to chair the Juvenile Justice Reform Council in 2019. This is me rushing to read my script. Of course, Esquire, is that you're a lawyer with your last name being Abbott. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us. I also have Mr. Eric Ford, who's a graduate of Hampton University with a BA in sociology, and he has a post-bac certificate in the nonprofit sector from UMBC, has more than 25 years of experience in the human services field in the Baltimore metropolitan area. Mr. Ford, how are you?
Good. Glad to be on with two of my favorite people, two of my mentors, Sam Abed and Freeman Hrabowski.
Well, I'm happy to have all of you here. Now that the introductions are finally done, I think the interview is probably at the end now, after me singing the praises of Freeman Hrabowski. Let me begin by asking you, President Hrabowski, what prompted you to write an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun discussing the over-incarceration of youth?
I have great respect for the Secretary. Secretary Abbott is an amazing leader who cares about our children. And we have been working with this choice program in partnership with the Department of Juvenile Services for 30 years. And I'm really proud of Eric Ford, who leads it. And as we have been talking, it was the Secretary who made some comment about our work together. And we collaborated and thought about how can we say to the larger community in this state that we are focused on solutions, that we understand the challenges, that we recognize that structural racism is real. We've got data that shows how children are treated by race and some of those issues. And we wanted to say through the Baltimore Sun to the state of Maryland that we are making a difference and we're doing some things. And you've got my two leading experts, one from the state level, from the university here in this matter. From the point of view of UMBC, our goal is to use whatever brain power we have, whatever commitment we have, to make a difference with the children of our city and beyond. So you're going to enjoy talking to these two people, and I'm glad to be with you today.
Well, Secretary, let me come to you next, because as everyone knows, I mean, because we talk about this so much in this country and on this show, youth of color are more likely to be viewed as criminals and are incarcerated at much higher rates than white youth. So if you're black or brown in this country, you are more likely to be treated more harshly at every stage of the system. What can we do to change this reality, particularly while we're in the moment where we're talking about the ways in which people are viewed through a racial lens?
I appreciate that question and the way that you framed it, because that's often the way that I frame it for my team. At each stage, it gets worse. And so whatever happened in the stage before they reached us, we contributed as well. And so we all have to take stock of what our contributions are to disparity, and then we have to evaluate what we can do. And for the Department of Juvenile Services, we want to look at what we can do, not what we can't accomplish. You know, I can't accomplish some things within other entities, but we can accomplish a lot here. And when we look at our system, we do see those disparities. And those things those disparities are calls to action. One of the things that we can do is use our diversion authority. And that was what we were talking about, Dr. Hrabowski and I, in our op-ed, is that the department has authority to divert youth that are charged with criminal offenses, if they're charged with misdemeanor offenses, with a couple of exceptions, we can divert those cases out from ever going to court. And so that is one way that we can start to mitigate. And we have seen that there has been some mitigation, but we have to do a lot more. We have to acknowledge, and everybody in the system has to acknowledge, that the disparity exists. And unfortunately, that's something that still has to be raised with some places where people deny that. There is a disparity. We have to acknowledge that disparity, and then we have to have data to show the disparity. And that data isn't meant to disparage people. It's meant to show where we are and are we moving the dial when we make changes. And that's why we've made that commitment to share that data, to publish it as specific youth of color data, so that we can see if anything that we're doing is having an impact. And then, of course, we have to act. As you said in your last segment, and as Dr. Hrabowski said in the op-ed, we have to be upset, yes, and we have to protest things that are wrong, and we have to demand change, and then we have to actually go out and make those changes happen. And so diversion is one thing that we can do, but I want to also point out another thing that we're doing at the department with our leader in race equity, which is who's Lisa Gary. And Lisa has developed, she developed a framework for discussing race issues in the context of our system, which was an important foundational piece. But after we've got through that training, she has rolled out a tool, a racial impact assessment lens. And we actually published that tool on our website and in our data resource guide. We use it internally to evaluate our procedures and our policy recommendations, because the reasons that we have these disparities can be traced to multiple sources. We know that there are disparities. We know that there is bias among individuals that make decisions. That is one source, but there's also structural racism. And structural racism is embedded in the policies and the procedures and the laws that we have. And they've been there sometimes so long that they get overlooked. And so using a race impact assessment lens forces our systems to systematically evaluate the racial impact of an existing policy or a proposed policy, and then specifically requires us to put steps in on how we can mitigate harm or advance equity or both. And those kinds of things are needed for not just justice agencies, but for all agencies that touch people.
So, Eric Ford, I want to come to you next. Given that you have a director for the Choice Program at UMBC, and you're also a member of the newly formed Maryland State Juvenile Justice Reform Council, can you talk to us about what anti-racist programming in the community would look like? How would that actually be applied, and how would it directly inform and change the lives of young people?
Sure. When we talk about, you know, anti-racism programming, it really looks at the criminal justice system, both locally and nationally, from a historical perspective, and takes into account, you know, how those things have evolved over time and how they've impacted youth of color, and using that information to inform your services. And one of the ways that we're doing that, or have done that, is that we've really incorporated young people's voice and their family's voice into the services they receive. And one of the major changes that we work with DJS in implementing is that when our program was first founded, we were heavy on monitoring, and which means that, like, so I'm a Choice alum, and when I was a mentor in the program, we were making home visits in the community and to young people up to 3 times a day, unannounced visits, where we would come by their house, visit them, their schools, and visit their homes just to check on them. And because of the volume of the visits that we had, they were really quick check-ins. We didn't have a lot of time to spend, you know, talking and really getting to know young people and their families. So what we've done is that we've changed our model, and we switched what we call from monitoring to mentoring. And we took our interactions from transactional to transformational, mm-hmm. which means that we work with families, and now we ask them the days and times that work best for them for us to come by to visit. We work with young people on goal setting and helping them acquire their goals. And we've found that our outcomes have improved since we made that change. Like, we're having increased contacts with young people, and the feedback that we're getting from young people and their families is that, you know, this is working for them and this is better. So, you know, you go back and when you look at an anti-racist approach, you go back and look at, you know, our program was founded in the late 80s, right on the precipice of the Biden crime bill, and young people were looked at and viewed as dangerous and violent, and you had to just keep tabs on them at all times. And we made a concerted effort to try to change the narrative that young people need support, they need services, they need guidance, and they need mentors versus a program that was heavily based on monitoring. And I really applaud you know, Secretary Abbott on supporting us in this effort, because it was something that they, you know, didn't have to embrace. But I actually work with Lisa Gary. He mentioned Lisa Gary, who works on race equity in the department. But I work with her. We talk, and we spoke about this change and if it was necessary, and how we could make it work. And so it was a great collaboration of everyone coming together and making a change and designing a program that worked best for young people and their families versus one that was based on a myth and one that was based on fear. So I'm really happy about where we are right now.
President Hrabowski, I want to come back to you. Now, you're someone who, at the age of 12, you were marching, you got arrested, you know, you got that speech from your principal about, yep. you know, the courage of nonviolence and civil disobedience. It feels like we are back in that moment again, where we're talking about the over-incarceration of youth, we're talking about racial equity and justice, and it feels like the needle is not moving. As someone who has the benefit of the long eye of history, where mm-hmm. we are at this moment, can you talk with us about how do we actually begin to radically transform this society, even if you're not a director or a secretary or you have a, you know, a business or a company, but starting where you are?
I appreciate that question, because I'm constantly saying we must know our history. If we don't know our history, we really don't know where we're going. We have no sense of context. And the two things I would say, number one, I could not have imagined as a child, as a black child in Birmingham, that we would have a secretary like Secretary Abbott who will speak the truth and say there is structural racism in our system. We have to start there. And back that statement up with data. This is what, I mean, I am fascinated by looking at the data and the disparate outcomes based on race. And so we start there. Number two, it is especially helpful when you can hear a young black man like Eric Ford talking about the fact that we are using a model that's more strengths-based, that we know our children in our communities have many strengths, that so many people could not do what they are doing in challenging situations, and most important, that we can listen to them, to those children, to those young people, and to their families, and not think we have all the answers, quite frankly, just because we've got more education. So we start there. That says to me, if we can have this kind of model across not just Maryland but in other states, we're at one piece of it. Now, there are many other pieces. And what I would say to you is this. Most important to me right now is what we're doing in our Center for Democracy to encourage people to vote. We've got to get people to vote and to understand the issues so that we can, quite frankly, select people who have values like the ones we're talking about, who will care about our children, black, Hispanic, white, Asian, whatever the color. And number two, that we can work with them to change these policies that people are talking about. I don't think many people understand how deeply rooted these racist policies are in American society without people even realizing ways in which children and people of color are disadvantaged. So I am encouraged by the notion that I'm hearing about more and more people who are willing to vote. Our campus is on it. Our students are out doing as much as they can. And that people see the connection between democracy, voting, and tearing down all of those racist policies.
Now, Secretary Abbott, I want to come to you because the Department of Juvenile Services, you handle everything from drug treatment to counseling services. But in the last 3 years, 90% of all the referrals of youth of color have come from the police, which means that most young people start with having that first touch coming from the police before they get into the system. How do we change that reality? How do we, is it defund the police? Is it abolish the police? Like, what can we do to change this?
Yeah, I think you're right. There, that is a problem. And I think it speaks to a lack of investment in resources in our communities. If we want to make sure that kids don't come into our system via the police or any other avenue that they might come in, then we have to have those resources out in the community. So, you know, we do work with police, and they do have police diversion. But if we want to do more primary type of not diversion, but prevention work, then we need to look at some of the other literature that's out there. One thing that I'd like to bring some attention to is school start times. Young people commit most of their offenses between the time when school ends, after school, which is for high schoolers pretty early in the afternoon, and until supper time. And in those hours, when they're unsupervised, is when most of the trouble starts. So if we just move the school time back, which there's a lot of literature that says, hey, we'll get better academic benefits, we'll get better attendance, and better performance out of our kids because they'll be better rested, we'll also get another benefit, which is that we'll squeeze out some of that unsupervised time. And those are the kinds of things that we can do to prevent kids from coming into the system. The other things is you know, bolstering what we do with our education system to go beyond just the book stuff. Kids need to have experiences. That's how they learn and how they grow. And if they're not getting that kind of exciting experience in their life, then they're going to seek it out. So if we can offer those opportunities, we can give them pro-social ways to get those experiences that they need to mature and to grow without putting themselves at risk of getting tangled with the juvenile justice system.
Eric, I'm thinking about cases such as Dante Harris. That was the African-American young person who was arrested for the murder of Baltimore County police officer Amy Caprio. I bring him up because prior to his arrest, his mother actually made a plea to the judge, one of the judges in the case with her son, asking, begging, pleading for some type of help, some type of reform. She said, because something's going to happen. He's either going to end up going to jail or he's going to be killed. And he's serving 30 years to life at this point. I know life is difficult for a young person, but I know it's at least 30 years. How do we intervene in a system like that? If the mother's crying out for help, how can we as a community begin to intervene?
Yeah, I think we definitely have to hear those parents' cries, and we have to step in and provide whatever support that, you know, we can. One of the unique things about the Choice Program is that, you know, young people, we don't just mentor young people. They're not our only clients. When a young person is enrolled in our program, everyone that lives in that household can receive services from us. So we have been very supportive of parents, cousins, you know, brothers, sisters, uncles, nephews, whoever is in that household is eligible to receive our services. So I think in some cases, you know, parents get very overwhelmed. You know, I think mom was crying out knowing that, you know, she couldn't do it by herself. And, you know, with some additional supports, I think, you know, situations, you know, may have been different. So I think, you know, in those cases, we have to hear those cries and be very, you know, cognizant and timely in providing those interventions and providing those supports. I think all too often we wait too long, and that's when, you know, things, when parents get really frustrated, or intervention time is missed, and you miss those opportunities to step in and impact and have a change.
Secretary Abbott, I wanted to come to you with the same question. Well, you know, with the Department of Juvenile Justice, what can we do? How do we lean in here?
So when folks are having issues like that, and you know, we always sort of focus in on the end of what happened at the very end, but there were things that happened far before that that were points that we needed to intervene, whether it was because, you know, lack of attendance in school. That's a flag that we need to get that young person re-engaged with school. We need to eliminate all those impediments that prevent people from getting back in school. Even when they get entangled with the juvenile justice system, things like using our diversion authority very quickly. One of the advantages to putting somebody into a program like CHOICE through our diversion authority rather than through the court system is that it's closer in time to the behavior that you're trying to change. And when it's closer in time, you've got a better chance for that behavior change, for that intervention, that program like CHOICE, to take hold and actually make a difference. So we do need to get those kids services as quickly as possible, but we also need to think about which system is the right system to respond when we have people that are in crisis. Is it the justice system that should respond, or should it be the social services system or the mental health system that should be responding? And I think that's the question that we need to face when we look at a situation like the one you mentioned. Let's not look at the end. Let's look at where we could have intervened much sooner. Mm-hmm. And which system is the appropriate system to intervene at that earlier stage before we're getting into any kind of violent offense?
And I want to pose my last question to President Hrabowski, because on the show, we're trying to connect everything back to voting, kind of as our final word. You use a quote in your op-ed, which is in the Baltimore Sun, where Dr. Mm-hmm. King said to you, "What you children do this day will have an impact on children who've not yet been born." Now, my Nana used to tell me, she said, when she votes for the children of her children.
That's right.
So can you talk with people just very quickly about why they must get some skin in the game and vote?
Yes. People have died so we can have this chance to vote. It hadn't been long when my grandmother had to go 3 times to pass the Alabama literacy test, and where her white counterparts could go and put an X there when they couldn't write. I mean, that's how challenging, just a few years ago back in the 60s. And so the key here is to make sure that we are understanding that the only way we can gain power is to use the power we have, and that's the power to vote and put in place people who will listen to what we're saying about the needs, whether it's in mental health or it's in helping in our communities and healthy relationships between the community and the police and the schools. We need people who understand that the voting leads to people who will either make it better for us or make it worse for us. And that's something that only comes about when people get in the game, when they decide, I can make a difference. It's not about one person. It's about all of us. It's the power of all of us as a community saying, we deserve better than this. We can do this. We just got to keep hope alive. It's so important.
Thank you so much, Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, the president of UMBC, Sam Abbott, Esquire, secretary of the Maryland Department of Juvenile Services, and Eric Ford, the director of the CHOICE program at UMBC. Thank you so much for your time.
Congratulations, Dr. K. We're proud of you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Okay.
That makes me very happy.
It's
Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Stay with us after the break, and we'll have more conversation.